Good evening, folks. This is Carolyn Evers, and as you know, this is one of my favorite times of the week, and I've got with me one of my favorite people.
Good evening, Carolyn. Good evening, everyone. This is Richard, and happy Easter to those of you who celebrate it.
Indeed. And because we are so close to Easter, our guest tonight is someone who is very connected to the Easter story. And Richard, do you want to tell our audience who that is?
Well, it's Joseph of Arimathea.
Yes. And he really does figure prominently in the Easter story, so we thought he would be a wonderful individual to happen tonight. And in case you're not getting our emails telling you who our guests are and giving you other information about the work that we do, Richard, how could somebody sign up to get on our list?
Sure. You just go to the2012countdown.com and you put your name and email address on the top of any of the pages of that website and acknowledge the email that gets sent to you, and it's all done.
All right. That's easy enough.
So
that's easier
I was thinking,
than baking cookies.
I was thinking it might be worth just taking a moment to provide a bit of an introduction to our guest tonight. I know some people will be aware of how he connects in with the story, but
that's an excellent idea.
I thought I might just take a moment to do that. Some people are aware of Joseph of Arimathea as being the individual who owned the tomb to which Yeshua was transferred after his time on the cross. And some others are aware of his turning up in Britain, and you might say beginning that particular branch of what has come to be known as Celtic Christianity in Britain. But the broader story of Joseph of Arimathea has perhaps best been told by that channeled book, Anna, Grandmother of Jesus, brought forth by the woman using the nom de plume of Claire Hartsong. And so she fills in quite a few gaps. And so Joseph of Arimathea was Mother Mary's half-brother. So they shared the same mother but had a different father. And Joseph of Arimathea was quite a bit older than Mother Mary was. And he also was the father of Mary Magdalene. So he was Yeshua's father-in-law and also his uncle. So a bit kind of intermingled there. But also, Joseph was perhaps the wealthiest man, at least in that part of the world, maybe in the entire world at that time, up until the time of the crucifixion. Firstly, he'd been a very successful trader, businessman, but also inherited quite a bit of property and so on through his first marriage. So he was an extremely wealthy individual. He was also a deeply spiritual man who had studied extensively with the Druids in Britain in particular, and was, I think, an archdeacon with the Druids. And also he'd spent time in India with Babaji and so on. So he had many of those, you might say, yoga-based skills as well. So he was quite an interesting individual. He was also a member of the Sanhedrin in his time, which you may know was the kind of like the high court, you might consider it, of the Hebrews at the time. I think it still exists in some form, but I don't believe it perhaps has the reputation you might consider that it had in that time. So he was an interesting individual, and he also was responsible for financing and supporting the travels, the educational travels of Yeshua up until the time of his brief ministry. So, for example, he took Yeshua to Britain to study with the Druids, I think at about the age of 13 or so, for something like 3 years, I think, and then brought him back and then funded his trip to India with other members of his family and a bit of an entourage, you might consider. So all of that was not inexpensive. And so Joseph kind of acted as the funder of all of that activity. So really he played a very important role, you might say, in the unfolding of Yeshua's journey. And of course, as I said, he was also Mary Magdalene's father. So you might consider he was a pretty important player in the unfolding of the story, the mission, the all of the threads, you might say, of that time of Yeshua and Mary Magdalene and all of the others involved, particularly the other Essenes. And as I said, he had many skills, not only Druidic and skills from India, but also, of course, the Essenes themselves had many, many skills that were hidden from those around them. So I thought it was useful to give a little of that background. So he was very wealthy up until the time of the crucifixion, and then it was recognized that he was very much part of what unfolded, you might say, with Yeshua, and so his wealth was stripped from him by the Romans. So he went from being very wealthy to pretty much penniless. And so when he went to Britain after the time of the crucifixion, he was quite poor and lived the rest of his life in that state. So quite a change for him. Really? So anyway, that's a little background to the man. Very interesting individual.
And I'm glad that you brought that forth. There's something else about him that I think is very important is the tin mines that he owned, because tin was very much desired by the Romans.
Yes, he owned the tin mines in Britain, in Cornwall, I think, is where they were located. So yes, he started out, I think, as a trader carrying the ore or whatever form it was shipped in, I presume ore, and then came to own many of the mines themselves in that area of Britain. So that's became a key part of his wealth.
It sounds like he had a real keen business sense.
I sense so, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful that you brought forth that background. Thank you so much, Richard. It's a big help to people who are not as familiar with him as they might be, and it's a big help, especially in this Easter season.
Mm. So perhaps we might connect with him and see what he's got to say. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea.
And he's here. And so let me describe his energy as I experience him. The core energy is really love. Above all else. And I sense married into that very, very keenly is wisdom. I suspect he was a very intelligent man. But ultimately, the man was about love, very, very powerfully and clearly so, and its expression. So I experience him very centrally, great peace about him, actually. He lived a pretty frenetic life, I think, for those times, given all that he was doing, and yet there is this beautiful peace about him. I suspect he always made time for those that were important to him. So that would be my quick thumbnail of my experience of his energy.
That's beautiful.
So let's see what the man has to say.
Good thing.
As you may know, I came forth on this show some 2 years ago, almost to the day. And again, my coming forth was triggered by this connection that I have to that mission of Yeshua and Mary Magdalene. And indeed, in so many ways, the mission of the majority of the Essenes, because really the core reason for the existence of the Essenes was to provide a platform for that mission of those two. We understood this very, very strongly, and although not every Essene was specifically dedicated in some manner to supporting that mission, there was this very clear understanding that what the Essenes were doing was gathering the knowledge and the wisdom and the skills that existed in so many streams of what you might consider spirituality or metaphysics or whatever terms you wish to use. And so amongst the Essenes, there were pretty much all of the skills you might have read about at various points. You might know that my mother Anna, Yeshua's grandmother, lived for some 800 or so years, and so she very clearly had the ability to master the aging process. So this is but an example, and she would depart this plane for periods of up to 30 or so years before returning. She truly had mastered this. And in addition, so many skills were mastered by so many. She was also a great master of the Druidic traditions and herself had also studied in India with the great Babaji. So these skills were quite widespread, you might say, not just within my direct family, but indeed within the Essene community, because it was recognized that, in a way, bringing all of the skills together to provide a platform for Yeshua and Mary Magdalene to do their work was really very, very important. And so I mention this because I see my life really as having been an honor and a privilege and also a life of service to that mission. It is why I took it all so seriously, you might consider, to fulfill my part in all of this unfolding. And it was a very important unfolding, not in the terms that Christianity has, you might consider, preserved it, though that is not the best term. But really it has been through the existence of Christianity that the memory of Yeshua has survived down into your time. And you may recall from the words of Emperor Constantine, when he came forth on this show, he shared with you that the core reason he set up the church as he did was he was less concerned about how it actually executed what it executed than it preserved the name of Yeshua down to your time. That was his primary focus. And you might consider that a lot of humanity suffered under the yoke of the Catholic Church through those centuries. But in truth, he served his mission very well, which was to preserve the name down through that time so it could bubble up in your time as it has been doing, not only within the work of these two, but indeed of many others, is the true understandings of what the Essenes were about, what Yeshua was about, indeed what we were all about in that time, which was to build the platform that in a way made what you are doing in your time possible. You see, the mission of those two was manifold. Firstly, it was to demonstrate some healing skills. Secondly, it was to, in a way, place a marker of sorts by demonstrating leadership in a spiritual sense in a public way. You see, many of these skills, as I said, that Yeshua displayed were already in place within the Essene community and, of course, within other groups across the planet, but they were hidden. And what Yeshua did was come forth and display them publicly. His walking on water, for example, was so extraordinary for those amongst whom he displayed it. But in fact, it was not such an amazing skill for those who understood it. And so it was really the public display of those skills that brought the wrath of authority down upon him, that above all else, these skills had not been displayed in public and the average person had no knowledge whatsoever of them. And so the audacity of displaying them in public, healing, walking on water, so many other demonstrations of the mastery of this physical domain, which so many held in secret across the world, were being demonstrated in this public manner. So this was part of what was being undertaken. In addition to this, there was the role of their children, which again, I know many of you understand, but they played an important role. There was the necessity of repairing the human DNA that had been damaged by off-planet beings that had come forth, you might say, to enslave humanity for their own purposes. In fact, they had actually come forth to make some corrections under, you might say, a fulfillment of a mission for humanity, but in fact, they got off track and enslaved humanity. And so damage had been undertaken to the DNA that needed to be corrected. And so there was this flowering, you might consider, that effectively began with the grandparents of those children, the parents of both Yeshua and Mary Magdalene, who represented key monads. And then you had Yeshua and Mary Magdalene coming forth in their own right as very important aspects of key monads, reinforced by their parentage, which meant that there was this power within the DNA of their children, which is hard for you to perhaps grasp. And so that correction to the DNA has flowed through the human population since that time. Great care was taken to protect those three children and to ensure that their DNA flowed out into the human population. And there have been individuals who have come forth again from those key monads to intermarry with the offspring of those children to again reinforce this as it spread out to ensure that this correction was undertaken. This indeed has been very hidden and perhaps has not been spoken about as directly as I'm speaking about it now. But it was a critical piece of the puzzle, you might say, to prepare for the time in which you find yourselves. So there were many elements to that mission of Yeshua and Mary Magdalene that were not well understood by anyone outside of the Essene community. It was very carefully hidden. There were others who understood the importance of that individual called Yeshua. The Druids understood who he was in a sense, but not the detail of his mission in totality. It was considered to be too high risk, you might consider, to have it shared beyond a very, very small group. So I share these things so you understand a little of the powers that we held, the abilities that we had mastered and kept in secret from the rest of the Hebrew community with which we shared our lives. And as history has recorded, it was not long after Yeshua's crucifixion that the Essene community was essentially overrun by the Romans. And it was of no great surprise, because you might say the sting had gone out of those communities, and many of them had left and moved elsewhere, to France, for example, and Britain and elsewhere. And so you might consider that focal point had been achieved, that moment had been expressed in all its glory, you might consider. And I'm not specifically referring to the crucifixion itself, which, as you know, did not see the death of Yeshua, but in fact that entire period of their lives and those who surrounded them, including myself and my wife and Mother Mary and the other Joseph. All of us were deeply involved with all of this, as was my mother Anna. So I paint this picture a little for you so you understand the power of that time, that the power of that moment, the power of the individuals who gathered to make all of this possible. It just wasn't Yeshua coming forth by himself, as the Christian story would have it be told. It was a far more comprehensive picture. There was such training and understanding in place into which Yeshua was born, and his training, you might consider, began really from the moment of his birth. Indeed, it is why those so-called wise men came to his birth. They brought gifts, not only of the type that are recorded in terms of frankincense and gold and so on, but indeed important teaching documents for the young Yeshua. Because the leading individual in the so-called three wise men of that Christmas story, the Balthazar, was in fact Yeshua's great-grandfather. Sorry, Yeshua's, let me get this right, he was Mary Magdalene's grandfather. And so he had a great connection with all of this picture. You might also be interested to know that Mary Magdalene was born on that very same day as Yeshua was born, because it was an important and powerful day. Not December 25th, as is celebrated, but indeed at another point in time during the year, a very auspicious moment that supported all that these were to do. And there is another piece of the puzzle, which I know some of you are aware of, in regard to that time of the crucifixion, and that was the time that Yeshua spent in the tomb, because the purpose that was fulfilled in that time was, you might consider, an energetic reconnection between this dimension and the higher dimension to which those of humanity which choose it will ascend. You see, this connection was broken during the time of the fall in Atlantis. It was not intended, but it happened. And so it needed to be repaired, and Yeshua understood that it was part of his mission to do so. There were other times and circumstances in which he could have undertaken this, but in fact he recognized that this time when his body would be healing after the trauma of being crucified would be a perfect opportunity for him to undertake this work. And so it was the key work that he actually undertook whilst, you might say, resting in the tomb for those 3 days. And this is why there is this imprint on the Shroud of Turin, which many have speculated as to whether, in fact, it is the imprint of Yeshua on that shroud. And I say to you that it is, in fact, his imprint which is on that shroud. And it occurred because of the energies with which he was working in that time. They were extremely powerful energies, and you might consider almost radioactive in their nature. I use that word because it is conveying a sense of the power of the energies, not that it was radioactive in the sense that you might consider, but rather it is why there was this imprint caused upon the shroud because of the energies that he was working with to do this reconnection. And that reconnection was completed in that time. So the Shroud of Turin, my friends, is a very real artifact. So this paints a little of the picture of that time in perhaps a broader manner than you have understood it in the past. And I will say that I feel honored to have been able to contribute to what that time was about, what that mission was about on so many, many levels, both financially and spiritually and, you might say, on a skill basis, and to really make, in my own way, all of what unfolded possible. It was a special time. And as you may recognize, I had to flee that area after the crucifixion, as indeed had the entire family. And so I moved to Britain to reconnect with the Druids who I knew well from the time I'd spent in Britain. It was a little like a second home for me on many levels. I had business connections there. I had many friends, including amongst the Druids. It was just a natural place for me to go after the crucifixion. And yes, history records that I indeed did begin to teach the messages of Yeshua in Britain at that time, and it formed the basis of what became known as Celtic Christianity. So this is really the picture that I wanted to paint for you tonight, so that you understand perhaps a little better the importance of the work that was undertaken in that important time, some 2,000 or so years ago, to prepare for the time in which you now find yourselves, this very special time when this transition in consciousness, this transformation will emerge that has been long spoken of and which is indeed very close to being in your experience. And so it is.
Thank you. And thank you for the two of you for this wonderful information. I invite our listeners to call in with their questions, but I would like to ask a question first, and that question is this. Give us some sort of understanding of Yeshua's personality.
Yeshua has tended to come down through the Christian messages as being a very serious individual, very focused on his mission. But really, on a private level, he was a very fun-loving, very mischievous individual, in fact, a highly intelligent man, a very caring and sensitive man, but very mischievous. He loved to play tricks on those around him. And he would very often be the life and soul of the party. You might look at what he was doing as being very serious, but in fact, outside of when he was working, you might say, on his mission, he was very lighthearted and carefree and really a very joyful individual to be around. as I say, he was quite a trickster, even from a very young age, and it never left him throughout his life. He was always a very enjoyable character to spend time with. I remember our times together very fondly, from the very youngest days to the very last of his days.
Thank you. And can you give us a little idea of Mary Magdalene's personality?
Mary Magdalene was, in some ways, perhaps a little more serious, though also playful in her own way. She had a great love of nature, very, you might say, connected to the earth and its creatures and plants. You may know that the Essenes were great herbalists. They would gather herbs for medicinal purposes on quite a broad basis. If they had the knowledge and they were traveling and the plants were in season, they would gather them and bring them back with them. And of course, they gathered them from the local area as needed. And Mary Magdalene was quite a master of these, you might say, herbal products, herbal derivatives, not only the plants themselves, but the medicinal products that the Essenes created from them. So she was a great healer in that traditional sense, not just energetically, but also in that herbal sense. And so this was part of her connection with nature. She also had this easy way with creatures that many people would avoid. For example, as a child, she would collect snakes and bring them home, much to the chagrin of those who shared the house with her. But they seemed in no manner interested in biting her or even reacting negatively towards her, because they understood the beautiful respect and love that she had for all creatures. And so it took a little training to discourage her from bringing the less attractive creatures home. But this was a reflection of her nature. She had this, you might say, it's not really an earthiness per se, but this very great connection to nature. And so she was full of love and compassion and a great desire to heal. But there was also a fun side to her also. You might understand that the Essene children were brought up with great discipline and structure from quite a young age. And so by the time a young Essene girl reached physical maturity, she was very wise, very well informed about so many things, including what it meant to be a woman in every sense. So she understood all of these things, but also she was wise in a, you might say, mystical sense. Her mother was also a great teacher of these things, taught originally by her father, Balthazar. And so Mary Magdalene's first teacher, in fact, was her mother, and also to an extent myself. So she was a very extraordinary woman, greatly gifted, greatly, you might say, compassionate for all things, and truly loved Yeshua with all of her heart.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Our lines are open now to our listeners for you to call in and ask your questions. Since we don't have someone calling in right now with a question, I would like to find out where Yeshua and Mary Magdalene traveled to after the crucifixion.
It is well recorded, though not well publicized, that they moved to France after the crucifixion. And there is abundant evidence in the south of France for the presence of Mary Magdalene in particular after the crucifixion. And again, it is well recorded that there is a cave in which she spent sometime mourning the subsequent death of Yeshua, because he did die younger than he otherwise may have or would have as a result of his wounds from the crucifixion. But they both lived out their lives in France. Indeed, it is very interesting that there is actually a chapel of sorts constructed by the Catholic Church, would you believe, in that cave in acknowledgement of Mary Magdalene. Yet there are aspects of the church that have called her a prostitute. It is so bizarre. And it is one of the things that the church has been quite good at, has been to, in a way, pacify and acknowledge the local communities where there has been truth present, but not publicize it more widely. And this cave is a classic example. They clearly were very much aware that Mary Magdalene was present there and lived out her life there. And indeed, some of them were aware that Yeshua had lived after the crucifixion and had also lived in France and died there. And they made a great deal of effort to locate his body and destroy it many years after their time. But they were unsuccessful because it still remains and it will be revealed in due course.
So I gather from what you said that that information is not allowed to be revealed presently.
It is not yet time for it to come forth. Indeed, the time for it to emerge is once this shift in consciousness has begun, such that those who might reveal it and the revealing thereof is not destroyed and cannot be destroyed by those who would wish to do so. It is important that those changes begin to unfold so that there is this protection in place. To reveal it today and the people who might reveal it would be at severe risk in the current circumstances.
Thank you. Again, listeners, we have open lines for you to call in with your questions. We have quite an authority here concerning the events surrounding Easter. Call in with your questions. It would be good to hear from you. And while we're talking about this, can you give us an idea of what Yeshua and Mary Magdalene are doing now, their work from the other side, and how it impacts the earth?
In many ways, what these two are doing today is no different from what they were doing when they were incarnate. They were focused on assisting humanity, and they were focused on bringing forth this shift in consciousness that is due to occur in your time. And they have both worked tirelessly since that time, really since their birth, you might consider, the coming forth of their soul aspects from their monads. Really from those moments, they have been focused on bringing forth this change. And their incarnation and their subsequent journeys have been very focused on seeing this unfold. Most souls, you might consider, after they've been incarnate, travel quite widely, you might consider, and choose a path of growth and development that can go in so many different directions. These two have remained completely focused on doing everything that they can to bring forth this transformation that is due in your time. And so they, as I said, are pretty much working on the same things they were working on when they lived on Earth. And I know that the two of you are very aware of their focus on seeing this unfold because they communicate with the two of you quite regularly.
Thank you. I would like to thank Joseph, for his very interesting information and his willingness to answer all of our questions and give us a great understanding of that time. And you, Richard, I would like to thank you personally for bringing forth his words so graciously. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure. I just want to see if he has something else to share with us.
We do have a caller.
Oh, do we?
Okay. Yeah, Mary on line one. Mary, what is your question, dear?
My question is basically, I've learned a lot of like theology in my life. My question is Jesus fully human? Is he divine? Like, I'm sort of interested in your perspective on that, if he's divine or human or what is what you'd say.
Richard, did you understand Mary's question?
I think, Mary, you're asking how does Joseph exist? In what form does he exist today? Is he you say divine? When you say divine, it sounds like you have a very can I say religious perspective on what a soul does after it after the end of life. So when you say divine, what do you mean exactly?
I guess I like how I like under. I don't know. That's a really hard question, honestly, for me to answer. Because I would probably say that divine would be the entire field compass God. But I guess my concept of God is basically like the entirety of everything and the energy of everything, and that's like the motive. The motivating and like energy that's pushing like the world. So I guess it's sort of a confusing question. And also like I've learned a lot of Catholic theology in my life, and so
yes.
I learned that God is both fully human and fully divine. And I guess completely trying to like understand what that means is sort of an issue as I've like gotten
okay.
older. And,
I got it.
So
I got it where you are.
Okay.
So that's cool. So let me answer your question as I would answer it from my perspective, Mary, initially, and then see what Joseph wishes to add. Firstly, in that broad sense of considering everything being a creation of what you would call God or the being in the center of this cosmos, let's put it that way. I would call that being all there is or source or prime creator, any term of that nature, in a sense comes forth from that being. And therefore, you are as divine, you might consider, as Joseph that we're speaking to is, or electronic device through which you're communicating to us. In other words, everything is divine in that sense. So it's not a, in that sense, it's kind of a self-defeating question. The answer to that is by definition, yes. Secondly, he's no longer incarnate. So implicitly, he's no longer human in that sense. But I would take it a little further for your understanding, and that is, when souls are first created or were first created, they're very large. We would call them a soul monad. They're quite massive and they exist in the center of the cosmos. Again, they're too large to move beyond the center of the cosmos. And so when we incarnate, our monads sent forth just a few particles of themselves to be your soul or my soul in this particular lifetime. And other terms for that are, a finger of consciousness or an aspect. They're interchangeable terms.
Right.
And so, when a particular lifetime ends, that soul continues to journey, however it chooses to journey, until the time when we approach the end of this cycle of Brahma, which you can learn about from Indian traditions, very, very long cycles, when each of the souls, you might consider, from that monad return to the monad before all of creation collapses back into all there is in the center of the cosmos at the end of that particular cycle of Brahma. So, you know, that's kind of gives you a broader picture. I would add to that that we most of humanity tends to have a view that the only thing which exists is that which has come forth from the creator in the center of this cosmos. And so it's been my experience that that's far from accurate, that indeed there are other cosmoses within this particular experiment in consciousness, and there are expressions of creation that are way, way beyond this cosmos, beyond in the sense of time or primordial in nature. And the notion of space and time, of course, all arises within the context of this creation. So what I would say to you is that the state in which Joseph exists today is as a soul journeying however he has chosen to journey beyond his life as an incarnated human being. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, wow, thank you so much. I sort of have another, like, question.
No, we can't go, I'm sorry, Mary, we can't go into another question. We have two other people who have called in. Grant on line two. Grant, what's your question?
Oh, yes. Hi, Carolyn and Richard. I would just like to know, we've been told that after rejuvenation, we will have 2,000 strands of DNA from the current two, and I'd like to know how this will affect the physical body as a result of these 2,000 strands of DNA.
Let's see what Joseph has to say about this.
Right.
It's important to understand that not all of those strands or all elements of those strands are indeed in the physical. That indeed they connect beyond the physical dimension. And it has been demonstrated in your world with the current two strands of DNA that they are sensitive to light, and indeed light itself fashions itself in a sense according to the presence of DNA. So there, in fact, is an extraordinary connection already in place that exists in relation to the existing two active DNA strands, as you would consider, though, in fact, much of the other so-called mitochondrial DNA is active in its own way. But when we talk about those 2,000, you have to begin to realize that the experience of being a human being as a result of this reactivation will be very, very different from what it currently is. You see, in the human experience prior to what you would call the fall in Atlantis, the ability of a human being to communicate with other forms of consciousness was simply implicit, to have an open and aware connection with your creator, with your monad, with all other fingers of consciousness from your monad, really with any other expression of consciousness so easily and naturally. It was, you might consider, as natural as breathing. And so quite a deal of the expanded DNA function, as I say, is non-physical, but also opens up this array of experience. So it's important to understand that this is a key element in the purpose of this expanded DNA structure. And so from a physical perspective, as you would understand, only approximately 2% of the existing human DNA is actually utilized in the two active strands. And so the remainder will be taken up, you might consider, as expressing the physical elements of those additional DNA strands. It is hard to grasp entirely how this picture works, but I hope you are getting a sense of this. Now, the other element of your question is how this impacts the human form. And as you probably understand, given your connection to the work of these two, the physical form beyond rejuvenation will be almost identical to its form as was expressed in Atlantis prior to the fall, and that is, it will carry a perfection that you don't see today, and it will not age in the way that it does today, and it has and will have the ability to heal itself far more comprehensively than the physical body does today. People don't stop and think how extraordinary the human body is with its ability to heal itself. You take it for granted, but really it is quite an extraordinary thing. And I will say to you that it will become even more comprehensive. And some of this can be done today if you have the skills. There are stories told of great yogis in India who, for example, have had limbs severed, who simply had the ability to reattach the limb and repair it within a day or so with seeming unconcern. And this kind of ability does exist today if you know how. But this kind of ability to, you might consider, reconstitute the physical form at will become readily available to everyone. So you might consider the expansion of the DNA is part and parcel of this emergence of this rejuvenated form, this form that humanity carried prior to the fall in Atlantis. And so it is difficult to, you might consider, separate the reawakening of the DNA from the refreshed human form. And people will notice such individuals. They will not just notice the perfection that they carry, but they will feel the energy of these individuals. They know they are different. They will notice the difference. They will feel them because of the power that they carry. Now, it is important also to understand that it is not simply a matter of the rejuvenation process turning on all of these abilities, because it is like learning any skill in life today. You need to understand the skills and abilities that you are capable of, and you need to practice them. Not everybody today can, for example, pick up a violin and play it like a principal cellist, a principal violinist could play it. That doesn't happen. And whilst such skill development will be a lot easier in that form, it still takes practice and focus to develop these skills, to reawaken them, to understand what is possible, and to practice and open up those skills. So I hope this gives you an acceptable answer to your question.
Richard, we've come to the end of the show, and Camilla is on line 3, but we don't have the time to get to her question. Camilla, can you call next week with your question, or send your question in an email to Richard? Richard, would you give Camilla your email, please?
Are you there, Camilla?
Hello?
Hi, Camilla. You have my email address?
Yes, I can send you a question in an email.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Well, folks, I would like to especially thank Joseph of Arimathea and for his incredibly wonderful information, and Richard, your skill and ability, your master skill and ability for bringing him forth. And this is a skill that Richard...
We've lost you, Carolyn, I think, or maybe you've lost me too. So if I'm still on the air, my friends, I think we've finished up for the night. And so
I think so.
I thank you all for joining us tonight, for those of you that came forth with questions. And Carolyn, thank you for your contribution. And Joseph, thank you for being such a wonderful guest and such a joy to work with and bring forth.
And yours too, Richard. Thank you.
Until
next
time.
Good night for now, folks. Until next time.
Indeed. Good night for now.